So, as you know by now, and we just talked about it, my dad died just over a week ago, August the 1st. I've talked about him here lots before, and as Kathy said, so many of you, I feel like you've tracked along, you know, these last 6 years, his journey with cancer. His memorial was this past Wednesday, so that's pretty fresh. When I try to summarize this complex, you know, soup of emotions that are in me at a time like this, I often end up somewhere around, how do I feel? I feel relieved for my dad and sad for the rest of us, you know, somewhere in that space. I wish you could all have met him. That would have been awesome. The talkie bit will not be a reworked eulogy, but if I didn't acknowledge some of these events in my reflections this morning, I'd just be faking it. So you can expect some of that. I can't predict my emotions all that well at the moment either, so if I'm a bit more expressive than usual, you know, I want you to know that I don't feel uncomfortable or embarrassed about that, which I hope will mean that you don't need to feel those things either, at least not on my behalf. I feel like I'm in pretty good terrain there. When we gathered several weeks ago at the Plett Ranch, we were deep into a couple of reflections on some of the problems that go with thinking about God as an interventionist being. And since then, we had one gathering where we met at the Slam Camp classroom. That was a small group of us. I sent around a video about that endeavor that I think is worth a few minutes of your time, or you can talk with Ashlyn, who was part of that whole week, or Arielle, or Sasha, all of whom kind of got to be in on the adventure in person. But one of the upshots of that was that what I chose to do on that particular week was to help us do an exercise that just was about stirring our ability to imagine where we are in a story that we hear. So I chose a story that none of us would know. I don't think anybody that was there knew that story. It was an old Norwegian myth. And we used that as a bit of an exercise in listening to a meaning-making story and trying to locate ourselves in it. So we didn't touch on this topic then either, and then last weekend we didn't gather at all. I got to spend last weekend with Corrine and our kids, and of course part of a time like that is telling stories, right? My dad had just died, and we were together as a core family and not extended family, and so we told stories. And I don't know if there's really a better way to remember than stories. Like, I don't know a better way to remember than stories. Stories are kind of curious critters, though. I mean, sometimes stories thrive on the details, but often as not, in storyland, the details get pulled all out of proportion to what we would call the facts. They just get yanked around because the storyteller is after something essential. They're after the essence of an event or a person, an idea. This is why, of course, like, you know, the fish keep getting bigger in fish stories. You may have noticed this in some story form or other. It's not about the inches of the fish. That's not what the storyteller's trying to say, right? So that just happens in stories all the time. And so in all of this storytelling about my dad, one of the essential themes that emerged over and over again was that my dad was a wanderer. When my brother Greg called to tell me that Dad had died, and with the exception of our family here in Winnipeg, my mom and all my siblings were with him at the end of his life, which is lovely. And I asked him, like, how had it been at the end? You know, what had that been like? I asked him to describe it for me a little bit. Not the easiest question to ask someone to answer, but he rose to it, and he described my dad's physical death to me. He described it as sort of a slow fade, where he breathed less and less until he didn't. It was quite peaceful, quite consistent with the way that he had journeyed with his illness all along. And then kind of to sum up his story for me, Greg said, it wasn't like he announced it. He was just gone. And then we talked about how that was just like Dad to leave like that. And what we were talking about was this essential thing about my dad, which is that he was a wanderer. If you went anywhere with my dad, one of the realities you had to be ready for was that he would suddenly not be there. This is just true about my dad. If my family of origin was a song, this was the chorus. Like, this was the thing that came up over and over again, and it goes something like this. Where's Dad? Usually the response, almost verbatim, was something like, I don't know, he was here a minute ago. And nobody would have any idea where he had gone. It just came up over and over again. As Davis remembered it in one of our conversations, you'd be walking down the street with my dad, and all of a sudden, he just wouldn't be there. And you'd turn around to kind of go, like, where'd he go? And maybe you'd catch it on time, maybe you'd be blocks later, because he didn't announce it. He just was gone. And so when you'd find him almost always in a conversation with somebody. And a total stranger, street-involved person, retail clerk, somebody on a construction site. If it's after the play, it'll be with some bit piece actor. We've got this great picture of him bent over having an eye-to-eye conversation with some junior member of the play you keep talking about, Ray, the Easter one. Help me. Anyway, right? So just whoever. And if it's a situation where there was building kind of things going on, my dad was a contractor his whole life, he'd be like off in some obscure corner of the site looking up. He always used to say, you know, nobody but contractors or builders actually look up. Everything happens down here, but if you want to know how it's built, you gotta look up, and he'd be off somewhere. He'd be gone. Where's Dad? Well, I don't know. He was here a minute ago. Whoop. And he did the same thing with ideas. I think some of my dad's working assumptions about the world included the concepts that everyone's story is worth hearing, and all ideas start out as intriguing. He was perennially curious about what others were thinking or reading. Corrine, as part of his memorial, told the story of when my parents were coming to visit, one of the things she would do is go to our bookshelves, and if you've been in our house, you know there's a couple of those. She'd go to our bookshelves and she'd pull off what she thought were some interesting books, and she'd just put them on the coffee table. She wouldn't say anything about them because she knew what my dad would do is he'd walk in, he'd sit down, he'd pick up a book, he'd start reading through it, and then we'd end up just having a great conversation about whatever that book was about. So that's just kind of how he operated. He was essentially a wanderer. Is there a wanderer gene, do you think? Is that possible? Because if there is, I'm pretty sure I've got it. And I'm pretty sure some of my progeny do too. I picture it as having a wanderer in my blood. And one of the implications of that is that I feel quite compelled to look for the essence of things, to try to get at the thing behind the thing behind the thing. Sometimes that's a gift, sometimes not so much. And I know by experience that it can certainly be hard on the people around me when everyone else is working a plan and I just disappear, literally or more likely into my own head. But this wanderer that I have in my blood can be pretty compelling. And these past weeks, it's been taking me to task about why believing in God as a being that sometimes swoops down to fix things but more often doesn't is a problem. And I've brought that exploration into this community, which I realize may not have been easy or simple. And because we've not all been part of these explorations, sort of in the on-ramp stage, I'm going to offer a short summary of the problem as we've explored it, and then I want to get on to my long-promised attempt to talk about the positive side of this, if you will, rather than just sort of opening up the problem or deconstructing belief systems that are built on certain understandings of it that are predicated on that interventionist idea. The short version of the problem of thinking about God as interventionist is simply that if God intervenes, by which I mean if God fiddles with human affairs and alters them one way or the other, then God is on the hook for every situation in which intervention appears to be needed but is not delivered. That's the short version of the interventionist problem. If God sometimes intervenes, then to be honest about that system of belief, we have to acknowledge that we are depending on a God that can be cruel or indifferent in ways and on a scale that is really a bit sickening, as is seen in situations where God chooses not to intervene, because we can be quite confident that the suffering of the world cry out for intervention far more often than it arrives. We don't have to leave this room to find someone who has that experience under their belt. In fact, we won't do it, but if we went down the rows, we probably wouldn't find anyone who doesn't have that experience under their belt. And if we wonder about the commonality of this, all we have to do is ask ourselves, what does that spontaneous gasp, "Oh my God," mean anyway? Who asks for intervention? Oh my God, who doesn't ask for intervention? This is where it gets messy and complicated for those of us that have kind of grown up in belief systems that mostly just assume that God is an interventionist being, which lots of belief systems do. Short sidebar, if you're not sure if you grew up in or hold that sort of belief system, all you have to do is a quick review of how you or the people around you pray. If those prayers include asking God to alter reality on your behalf or on the behalf of others, then God is assumed in that system of belief to either be or is understood to be interventionist. That's the simplest litmus test I know around this. Dear God, please make X happen when X is not happening, or is not logically likely to happen, or sort of you can see the on-ramp to it, is asking God to be an interventionist. Right? Does that make sense? A core complexity of considering any other way to thinking about God than ways we're familiar with is that we often simply don't know how to do it. Like if we try, nothing happens. We have no roadmap for it. Because the other roadmap is not just familiar, but assumed. It's always been there. It's gravity. It's idea gravity. So that's a complicated space, right? For instance, if we start talking about the problem of God as an interventionist being, and we kind of back away from that idea and we go, well, what happens if I try to imagine a world in which God is not an interventionist being? One of the places lots of us come to really quickly in a journey like that is, why pray? Like really, if you're not asking God to do something, why pray? If I do a mental checklist and go, what do most of my prayers sound like? Where do they end up? I'm asking for something. I'm asking for X to happen from the outside. Well, a question like, if God isn't an interventionist being, then why bother praying at all is a great question. And one of the reasons it's a great question is because it leads right into another question, which is that what my relationship with God is comprised of? Is it a kind of a vending machine exchange in which I put in, I don't know, what do I put in? I put in obedience, or I put in devotion, or I put in right belief, or I put in confession, or I put in money, and what I get back is intervention when I ask for it. I paid up front. I gave it the office. It's kind of harsh when you put it like that, isn't it? But if I feel like there's no reason to pray if it might not get God to do what I want, then that kind of points to why I've been praying, right? To just be blunt about it. I've said this before, but I think it bears repeating. None of this exploration is meant to talk anybody out of a cherished system of belief. That said, I feel quite unapologetic about suggesting that unexamined systems of belief are at best hazardous and at worst destructive, both to us and to those around us. Somebody in this community sent me a cartoon last week that said, I've been thinking about the things we've been exploring in the talkie bit the last while. And that was sort of their whole explanation for the cartoon. And it was two-panel cartoon. First panel was two guys sitting on a concrete wall, contemporary scene. They're obviously deep in a heartfelt, emotionally laden interaction. One of them is saying to the other, you know, Brett, don't worry about it. Like, this is all part of God's plan. It'll work out. Next panel is God. God kind of looked like me, actually, but his beard was longer and he was bald, so he'd already arrived where I'm headed. But old guy, right? And God's kind of like, and his little thought bubble says, one, create universe. Two, give Brett childhood trauma for which he has no way of coping until he's destroyed everything in his life. I love the way cartoonists can, like, sum these enormous dilemmas in two panels, right? Oh, man. If we want to believe in God as an interventionist being, then at the very least, we should know that we're living out of a system of belief that has some pretty significant problems associated with it. And now, we could say the same thing about This could be a long list, but let's hit some high points. We could say the same thing about capitalism or free enterprise or democracy or gender or monogamy. We could just go through all kinds of big systems that our society has perking away in it and go, you know, that could use a better iteration. That needs a new iteration. So, don't panic. We're not done exploring. We're not done evolving. This is just in that. Okay, so back to the lane I was trying to stay in. This is the wanderer that's in my blood. When I talked about this last, this is so awesome, I can blame all kinds of things on my father, and he's not even here to defend himself. That's not morbid. It's just a fact. When I talked about this last, I gestured toward the idea that I want to open up a bit more this morning. I suggested then that one way to start to engage our imaginations about other ways of thinking about God in this particular matter might include thinking about God as being love and justice. Not God as a being that does loving and just things. Because if we think God about a being that does loving and just things, we're still thinking about God primarily as a being whose essence is power. And then doing loving and just things is a way of exercising that power. But the thing behind the thing behind the thing, the essence of our idea about God in that model is power. God is power, would be the shortest way I know to say it. All right? So, not God as a being that does loving and just things. Because if we stay in that space, that still leaves us with this rather large problem of how do we make sense of God not using God's power for good in the face of enormous evil and suffering. Right? The other side of the same coin. Let's carve this down even further just to see if we can access it a little more readily. We're going to leave justice off for the moment, not because it doesn't matter. It matters a great deal, and we'll come back to it, but let's just work with one enormous thing at a time, okay? Just for a moment. So let's just talk about love. If you want background on some of this stuff, you can go back and listen to the July 22nd podcast once I put it up. I'm a little behind, but next week. What if we imagine God's only power as being love? What if we imagine God as a being with no power other than love? Would be another way to say the same thing. How would a God like that inhabit or be involved in the world that we live in every day, including these situations of enormous suffering, trauma, evil, disruption? Well, most of us know from our experience that love, true love, doesn't turn away from suffering. So if we think about God as love, it's not that hard to imagine that wherever us humans find the strength or the courage or creativity to address evil and tragedy with goodness and compassion, we find God. And we might start to realize that wherever we find the creative imagination to do those things, we find God living and working within the human person. In traditional Christian theology, we've called this presence that I just described in non-traditional language, at least not formal theological language, in traditional Christian theology, we've called what I just described the Holy Spirit. Same thing, different language. Now, Holy Spirit's a pretty good descriptive term, but not if we use it as a weapon against people that call that good presence by some other name. Pretty hard to call that holy. Whenever we find something relentlessly pressing us toward a life in which love prevails over hatred or where justice prevails over oppression, in this picture, that's where we find God. And all of this points toward another interesting problem that we'll explore in some coming weeks. This is the problem of God operating from outside of or separate from the world that we live in rather than in it. Don't answer this, but when you or I ask God to intervene, where do we think God is coming from to do that? What's the address? It's probably not here. So, what happens to this whole bundle if we think of God as already inhabiting every atom of the universe? How could God intervene if God is already interacting with, intermingling with all of the things that we think of as laws and patterns of nature. Because when we ask God to intervene, that's what we're asking for. We're actually asking God to mess with a pattern. We're actually asking God to fiddle with a law. And we don't have to back the philosophical truck up very far to go, nature is, philosophically speaking, historically speaking, the underpinning of those laws. This is the way, we might say in ordinary speech, this is the way the world works. God, just for me, just for the person I love, just for this, could you just screw with that? Could you just crank that a couple of degrees to the left so that the tidal wave doesn't hit them? See what I'm saying? But what if all of that, what if all of that is where God is? Then what happens to the way that we imagine the presence of God in the whole spectrum of our experience? One of my favorite poets on this is a poet named Gerard Manley Hopkins, who says in his amazing poem called God's Grandeur that God is the dearest freshness deep down things. And he goes on in that poem to talk about how that image of the divine dwells at the heart of everything, but it bursts out in moments of light and energy, and I love this picture, like shining from shook foil. A lovely line. Hopkins is about, all about a thing called sprung meter. Anyways, that's a technical poetry thing, but if you read them, you have to read them out loud, because part of what makes Hopkins work is just the way he sounds. Like shining from shook foil. You know, you take a piece of wrinkled foil and you shake it, and the light just goes off everywhere. But it's no single thing. Love that image. We can believe in a God like that if we believe in a God whose only power is the power of love. And you can see that kind of notion of God revealed in many lovely ways in the story of Jesus. Now, I suspect that some of you may have been starting to wonder if I'd forgotten that story. With all this talk of God proper. Nope, I have not forgotten that story. I think the ideas in the Jesus story, ideas like God entering the world as a helpless child who lives in poverty, God being embodied in the experience of someone that experiences displacement and oppression, someone who never attempts to rise to power but repeatedly subverts it, somebody who redefines authority as serving one another, somebody who makes a mockery of supremacy by riding into the occupied capital on a juvenile donkey instead of a white horse, somebody who ends up dying mostly naked on a device that the Romans cooked up to cause fear and shame. I think that that story launches a theological revelation that reveals to us a God whose very existence is love itself. So, what does that imply about God being present in the sorts of situations where we might find ourselves calling out for an interventionist being? Well, it seems to me that if God is totally immersed in the world and in the life of humanity, then there is no moment where God is absent. In my dad's last breaths, in the suffering of every cancer-ridden cell, of every experience of every person that has that disease or any other, under every crushed building from the earthquakes or mudslides of this week or next week, in those damn stupid inadequate rafts that are filled with people and their hopes that get launched into the Mediterranean every day, in the body of every person that is raped or murdered or abused today and every day, and every assault and every systemic injustice and every racist attack and every phobic gender-based outrage, in every one of those moments and endless numbers like them, I can believe that God is present, not as a miracle cure for the ills of the world, but as the power of love and the soul of the world, sharing in its pain, but also being the breath of life and hope and courage in seemingly impossible situations. But for me to do that, at least, I have to shift into a space where I think about God's soul power as love. And not just that, But I have to think about that power as embedded inextricably in every part of the world. When I say God and I try to imagine the address, it's not somewhere else. Can I tell you that this is certain? No, I cannot. But I can tell you that the wanderer in my blood keeps pointing me down this path, and so I have to explore it. Peace.